So just in terms of framing this a little bit. So I can talk about the story of this piece in terms of like how a piece like this develops, if that's something that you want to hear about. But in terms of just trying to think about the problematic that this piece is trying to take on, I think I might just start with a very kind of glaring contradiction, which is that, you know, the United States is the by far the most powerful state in world history by measures of sheer wealth, military power, and energy consumption and contribution to global warming. I mean, if we just use those as rough metrics, there's no question the United States is the most powerful state that has existed. And in that context, we often refer to powerful states using a language of empire, but not the United States, right? And that to me is a really striking, and has been a really striking fact in the historiography. And that said, you know, as I point out, there have been historiographies that have used the language of the imperial or imperialism to make sense of the United States very, very productively. I mean, I wouldn't be able to write this piece without the existence of this enormous literature that I'm critiquing, organizing, framing, reframing. And I think it's also very striking that avoidance of the language of empire tends to happen within the U.S. Academy more than in other parts of the world, right? So there is a geographic dimension to that avoidance or skittishness about the category of empire. One of the things I found very striking is, like, I'll be reading a scholar writing within the kind of Anglophone scholarly framework, and they're perfectly fluent and confident using a language of empire to talk about the United States, and I'm thinking about, wow, this is really interesting. And, like, you know, half the time the person is Canadian, right? Which is really interesting, right? Because I think that's part of a kind of, you know, felt experience of, you know, growing up outside the United States, being subject to certain kinds of American power where that becomes part of your structure of feeling, it becomes part of your analytic vocabulary. Whereas in the United States, which, you know, by virtue of U.S. empire, has this enormous footprint in the global scholarship, there's this ambivalence, right? There's this, like, avoidance and all of this kind of hand-wringing over the concept. So I think one thing to kind of think about is trying to historicize why is that the case? Like, what is it about this concept politically in terms of its own intellectual history, its own genealogy that can tell us something about, you know, why scholars operating in lots of other parts of the world have very little problem using this term, right? Why American scholars who have a disproportionate impact on the global conversation are fighting back on this and in some ways creating the problem, I think, again and again. So that's part of what this thing is doing, is trying to historicize the dilemma that it's also trying to solve. And I think there's a kind of genealogical dimension to this project in this essay, even as I'm trying to kind of move this conversation in some new directions. One thing that I want to kind of clarify about the piece is just that the word empire can become a fetish in and of itself. And in a way, part of what I'm also trying to kind of create a genealogy of is how that becomes such a problem, you know, particularly during the Cold War. And I think thinking about the ways that, you know, the expansion of U.S. historiography under Cold War auspices, under this rigid ideological framework in which, you know, empires were what other bad states did, not what the United States was doing, right? That became, you immediately were sort of politically anathematized if you use the term empire to apply to the United States during the Cold War. Because that was what the Soviet Union was, and what Nazi Germany had been, et cetera, what, you know, Imperial Japan had been. So that turns the word into a fetish in down to the present. And a lot of what I'm trying to do in this piece is to sort of defetishize it in a way and to sort of say, look, this is a term that does certain kinds of analytical work that the field of U.S. historiography needs done. But if we can do it without the term, let's do it. I mean, you know, there's no particular reason why the term empire needs to be the centerpiece of this. But it's that it, you know, I think the way I think about it in the piece is pragmatic, which is to say the term empire opens up certain kinds of questions that other concepts don't. And also that if used in the right way, it can help overcome a lot of endemic bad thinking in the field of U.S. history, in the field of U.S. foreign relations history specifically. And that in the absence of the term or its misuse, it facilitates a lot of bad thinking in these fields. So that it's not so much, you know, the question of, like, do we need the category of empire or do we need to use it everywhere for everything? And I think people have sometimes read the piece in this way, where I'm quite explicit that there are certain ends that need to be accomplished in the field, certain questions that need to be asked. Empire is, in some ways, an indispensable tool among many other tools conceptually to open up those questions. What are some of the bad thinking that I'm talking about? I would say technocracy. So a scholarship that essentially understands the study of the U.S. and the world as a kind of managerial exercise, and there's a huge kind of revolving door between IR, U.S. foreign relations history, and history where essentially international historians see themselves as a kind of policy science for the national security state. And I think those sort of technocrats have often avoided the language of empire because of its critical politics. And I think that's a useful function of the category of empire, is to displace that kind of technocratic knowledge and to sort of say that's not actually what the field of U.S. history should be doing. I think the category of empire has a certain kind of critical relationship to what I would call kind of capitalist cosmopolitanism, sort of the 1990s discourses of a world becoming interconnected, and the interconnected world being one in which national chauvinisms would erode and human freedom would be unleashed. And I think a lot of the internationalizing of U.S. history that was called for in the 1990s and early 2000s inadvertently, in some respects, and in some cases deliberately, brought on board a lot of the kind of politics of capitalist cosmopolitanism. And I think the category of empire gives us a sense of the hierarchies of the global order, the very real and salient inequalities at a global scale, in a way that kind of helps us see that capitalist cosmopolitan discourse as symptomatic, right? It's not a point of departure analytically that we should take, but it's actually something that we need to kind of create a genealogy of. And along with that, I think the discourses of liberal internationalism that emerged, especially after World War II, which become the kind of dominant idiom of American power and scholarship, and which really sets the terms for especially the field of U.S. diplomatic history, really down to this day in some respects. And the challenge of, you know, and that is a, you know, a discourse that's about the United States as a kind of first among equals, among nation states, right, presiding over a world of formally equal symmetrical nation states within a world order characterized by, you know, open trading relationships, the rule of law, right? All the things we were hearing these days about the rule-based order that is, you know, supposedly under siege under the current regime, that kind of, that language made its way very sort of powerfully into the scholarship on the United States' relationship in the world, in part because of a kind of revolving door between policymakers and historians and other kinds of social scientists and scholars. So I think the category of empire was anathema to those actors because, again, of its critical politics, because of its role in Cold War discourse. And for that reason, it has a kind of disruptive or displacing effect on that form of authority. And that's very much a self-conscious goal in the piece. So what I'm hoping to do is in this piece is to suggest that if you take a term in a field that is controversial and debated and just has all of this charged energy around it, if you look at how it's used and how it might be used, you could both map out the development of the whole field in some ways. You could read, and you know, at its outer edges, that's kind of the ambition of this piece. It's really an attempt to map out the whole field of U.S. and the world in some ways, using this place where there's all of this charged energy and debate. And that you might also steer the field in some ways and to some degree in a productive new direction, right? You sort of say there's something in this category, right, that people keep coming back to again and again as a problem. So there's something generative there that can be directed and can be used to kind of steer the field in some ways in a more productive direction. And then, as Moses mentioned, also, it can help construct bridges to other scholarships, right? That one of the things that I've been frustrated about is the way that the kind of Cold War categories really partitioned off the United States analytically and conceptually from lots of other historiographies. And I guess, you know, my inspiration as I was, you know, coming up in the field and training myself was the field of, you know, European imperial historiography, which was making these connections and then sort of living, you know, in an imperial United States and wondering why we didn't have this literature, you know, why these questions weren't being asked for the United States. And so my hope is that this is in some ways an effort of kind of giving back, to sort of take this scholarship that I've learned so much from, you know, take these questions, run them through the U.S. case historically and historiographically, and then see what kind of conceptual dialogues can be created between the U.S. in a way to overcome some of the exceptionalism that I think has characterized this field, where you just don't talk about the United States as parallel to or connected to other imperial formations. In terms of, you know, the specific things that I'm pointing out that empire can do, I have these three things in the essay, right? That it foregrounds power against these technocratic discourses, against these sort of false egalitarian discourses, that it emphasizes connection, not just power over, right? In which the units of analysis are understood to be distinct, but you actually have mutual transformation, right? So the United States becomes what it is, you know, through its imperial history, in the same way that other nations are being made and remade through their engagements with the global order, including American power, right? So this is not just about power over or subordination to, you know, but rather a question of mutual imbrication, right? That these are, this is a process by which, you know, histories are becoming entangled in these asymmetrical power relationships. And then finally, comparison, right? To overcome these exceptionalisms and to really think about the United States comparatively in light of the history and historiography of other empires, right? We have this enormous literature where you can take aspects of U.S. imperial history that are really comparable to other places and engage in really fruitful comparisons, but only if the analytic vocabulary is in common, right? So you're not using these technocratic Cold War discourses which are about partitioning off, right? But you rather self-consciously find concepts that allow kind of bridge work to occur between historiographies. Why don't I just open up there? I'm really just curious to talk with you guys about the piece and about how you all are engaging these questions and.
Let me be a little bit selfish here.
Before
we open it up, because this seminar we conceptualize it as both methods and historiography. Okay. So we're trying to cover both grounds. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not successfully, but since we're here, it's not often that we have you here. So let's maximize our benefit from you. Tell us if you could tell us, walk us through the genealogy of the piece itself. I mean, it's life cycle. How does something like begin? A piece like this, how does it begin? How does it incubate? How does it mature, both mentally, but also in writing?
Yeah.
What are the stages? What are the stages of mutations that it undergoes before it becomes something that ultimately, you know, appears in this prestigious venue, the AHR? You know? That's what I mean.
Sure. So this piece, germinated for a long time. I think, you know, it's funny. On the one hand, it germinated for a long time in terms of me just engaging this literature for a long time and just, you know, wrestling with it, being frustrated with it, reading broadly within U.S. history, but also non-U.S. history, and trying to think historiographically about these disjunctures that I mentioned. So, on one level, a lot of this has just been brewing through the reading I was doing and the teaching I was doing. In terms of the immediate impetus, I was asked to review a book manuscript for a press, and I was very frustrated with this book manuscript. And I ended up writing this, 10-page, single-spaced response.
Did you guys hear that? Make sure you
get that. Yeah, I mean, I just, like, it was one of the, you know, it was this combination of just, like, frustration, but me working through my ideas. And I wrote this thing on the, you know, the press editor was like, wow, okay, you know, and then I just looked at it and I said, actually, there's a lot here. Like, this goes, what I'm laying out here, it goes well beyond the limitations of this book, mm-hmm. right? So, and I think that's one reason why historiographically, I often think that efforts to kind of engage in historiographic intervention come from those moments of friction and clash, where you just, there's something in what you're reading that rubs you the wrong way. And the key, I think, is then to figure out what beyond just peak or just, you know, crabbiness is, what's the substance of that, and is it consequential, right? I think that's the, so it was kind of me saying, okay, this is, you know, on one level, this book was perfectly viable as scholarship within the existing terms of debate, right? So to the point where I was being sent it as a manuscript. So, you know, so somebody thought this was viable in terms of the way it was conceptualizing. You know, my framework was there were a lot of problems, but that clash is what helped me conceptualize to myself what the problems were. And I realized, because I kind of had this, you know, ridiculous sort of overcompensation in terms of, you know, writing this response, that I had a lot to say, for better or for worse, about what the difference was between my thinking and the thinking of this book. So that was the starting point. So then it really began as a series of me, you know, trying to break apart kind of what my discontents were. And I realized that I had these quarrels with sort of the larger field, and that they played out in lots of different registers and they took on lots of different shapes. And so I began to just do a lot of outlining, where I just began to kind of write out, okay, if I had to break down kind of what the problems are in the way empire is being conceived in the literature and how it's being used and how it's not being used, what, you know, how would I categorize and organize those? And I began to, outline those. And then I began to kind of take it on the road, where someone would invite me to give a talk, and I would decide to just kind of give them a think piece talk about, you know, empire in U.S. history and how do we think about it. And those were enormously generative, just in terms of me kind of figuring out what people reacted to, what they were drawn to, what compelled their imagination, what they misunderstood from what I was saying, what my responsibility was for that misunderstanding, right, where there was something about the way I was framing things that was not getting across. People pointing out, you know, historical cases that were going to be helpful, conceptual nuances, just like all that I could just build back into the piece. So as I began to kind of go on the road with this, it became a work in progress, where, I mean, this was before I really set down any serious prose. I mean, it was just kind of outlining at that point. But it was a very dynamic outline where it just, you know, and you know, one important context for this was the, you know, the war in Iraq, where there was a lot of public debate about, is this imperialism? What does it mean that, you know, the United States is doing this, you know, et cetera, in a way that I found very recognizable historically, right? This periodic debate about imperialism that I talk about at the end of the piece, right? This coming and going, there are these surges where this suddenly becomes salient and then it goes away again. And this was a moment where this was salient. And so there were a lot of panels and invitations to say, well, you know, what do we do with all this? And so, an important context for me too was that I was very involved in the anti-war movement. And so, you know, there's a political context for this piece as well and so I was reading widely in anti-imperial literature and scholarship, and that made its way into the kind of animus of the piece, even as I did not want the piece to be polemical. I did not want the piece, you know, I mean, there's lots of scholarship out there that, you know, from the Vietnam era and from the Gulf War era, and et cetera, that is just extremely polemical, not very conceptually subtle, dates itself instantaneously, and, you know, things that I agree with and things that I'm very sympathetic to, but I didn't think it made it didn't justify a scholarly intervention, because it didn't have what we're looking for on the scholarly side of things, which is, you know, kind of conceptual acuity and being able to ask sharp questions. questions that have a politics to them, right? So I think when you move into the scholarly domain, it's not that politics is left behind. I mean, quite to the contrary, everything we do here is political. But I, that was definitely a part of, you know, kind of what animated this as well. So, in terms of some of the, you know, some kind of taking it on the road in 2000, I guess, 8 and 9. I mean, I'm taking this kind of outline that I've also begun to share with a lot of friends and colleagues. And here, I think intellectual community is really important. Where I would just, you know, send it to, you know, the smartest people I know, and just people that are way smarter than I'll ever be, and just saying, like, wail on this thing, like, tell me what's wrong with it, and they did, and then I would sort of, you know, work on trying to figure out, okay, how can I make this better? And you know, even as I read the piece now, there are moments where I can, you know, I reread it this morning and, you know, fearfully thinking, I'm going to hate this. Like, I'm going to think this piece sucks. And much to my delight, I don't think it sucks. But as I was rereading it, being like, yeah, that's the conversation I had with so-and-so where they put me onto this, you know, and they, you know, this is kind of, and it was a really pleasant kind of revisiting of my own kind of intellectual dialogues and my indebtedness to, you know, scholars that have taken up their time and energy and insight to help me build this thing. I mean, so the long list of, I mean, in some ways, you know, for me anyway, the probably one of the most telling things about the piece is my acknowledgments list. It's just like all the people that took of their time to contribute intellectually, and also in terms of morale and moral support. That's an important part of it too. People that said this is worthwhile. Like, this is, you know, we need this in the field. This will be a useful. Like, I think I needed that because this was a more ambitious piece than I had ever written, and you know, I wasn't sure whether I was entitled to write it, you know. So I sort of like, well, who am I to, you know, this is a field that's been going on for 100 years. Like, well, who am I to try to organize this and to critique it and to make these big claims and to take on? I wasn't sure that I, you know, merited that space and that kind of authority. And I still don't. But my friends were kind of like, yeah, this is new. This is really going to be helpful. You should, you know, I can't wait to teach this to my students. And that for me anyway, I mean, that's my own stuff, right? That may not be an issue that you all have. But that was very helpful. So it was the critiquing, the moral support, and the sense of egging me on, like, hey, we need this. I need this in my graduate seminar at some point. So those were, you know, then I had a leave year, and I was on a fellowship, and I decided I wanted to get some book work done because I knew that was what was going to count professionally, was getting my book written. And so I started work on this book on immigration, made a lot of headway, but decided in the middle of the year that I was going to take a couple of weeks out because I wanted to write this thing. It had kind of reached the point where getting some prose on paper was going to be useful. And so I took a lot of these dialogues I've been having on the road and with friends and started writing chapters and kind of, and I got a draft out, and like the first draft, I want to say took between 2 and 3 weeks to draft from one end to the other. So it was one of these things where, having talked about this a lot and worked on this outline for a long time, the actual sitting down to write it, and a lot of that had to do with the leave and the fact that I could actually really focus, I think it was relatively fast for me anyway. And the first draft was very flawed. I mean, it had a lot of problems. And then that became the thing that I could send around to people, and they could react to things like the structure, the flow, right? With the outline, they had to kind of imagine some of that, but now they really had a conventional text to kind of engage with. And so that's where I actually feel like a lot of the detail work really began to take shape. And so basically, you know, if I drafted it, I want to say I drafted the piece between, you know, like mid-December and mid-January, the year of the leave. And then I I think I ended up sending it off to the AHR for a first assessment that spring. I want to say, yeah, I think I sent it off like in March, you know, and their process is that they have this wonderful editorial process where they will actually have the editorial board look at something and get back to you very quickly about whether they're going to send it out for review. So you get a kind of up or out very quickly. So you're not wasting a lot of your time wondering whether this journal is going to pan out. I mean, and mostly they say no, you know, but that's helpful because then you know you can move on very quickly. You're not just sort of dangling. So so they expressed a lot of interest, basically. They said, we've sent it off to some of our editorial board. You know, I think they sent me the text of a couple of the responses that were enthusiastic and said, you know, this is a piece that's going to require some, you know, challenges in terms of what it's trying to do, especially vis-a-vis the space constraints of the journal. It's a piece that was kind of bursting at the seams in lots of respects. But we're interested. So, you know, keep working at it. And so, so I think basically the main challenge, I think I sent them something that was like 12,000 words. And the journal said, we will only publish something that is 10,000 words. And so, but the nice part was they said footnotes don't count, right? So I knew, and one of the, I mean, there were a number of reasons I went to the AHR. One was that I wanted to create this dialogue with other fields. And there was something about the intense provinciality and nationalism of American scholarship. I was just like, I can't be trapped in that. Like that, this is, and also just realizing this piece is probably not going to make it through the review process of the Journal of American History or other journals, because it's just like, you know, it's for these reasons, I think it's just not going to be legible, but it will be legible to the kind of more global editorial board. I mean, that was part of it. And then some of it was the footnote thing. I just, this is going to be a piece that has ridiculous footnotes. And the AHR, I think, is the only journal that I know of where they just give you that space and say, you know, it's got to be 10,000 words, but that's just in the text. But go to town on the footnotes. And so, so I was like, I'm there for that. So, so I spent part of the spring doing this really painful work of taking 2,000 words off of it. And at the, it was kind of at the micro level where there, I had written the piece in a way that there weren't pieces I could lop off of it. It was just a piece where I had to kind of wring it like a sponge, where I was literally taking words out of sentences. And then I finally wrenched the thing down. It took me about a month. But I got the thing down until the point where it felt like it was about as dense as a brick, which I think it remains as dense as a brick. But I got it to, I think I got it to 10,050 words. And I said, guys, can you give me the 50, you know, please? And they said, okay, you've been working on this a month. Like, what can we give you the 50? And so they sent it off for peer review. I got peer review back in, I want to say, 3 months, something like that. They sent it off to a lot of readers. I'm going to forget exactly how many. But I want to say it was like 6 readers. The responses were, you know, were positive in terms of their tone and just their sense of, this should move forward. There was nobody who said, this should not happen. But there were a lot of critiques, some of them I thought valid, some of them not valid, some of them helpful, some of them not helpful. You know, the whole peer review process for me at this point is a little bit of a blur to reconstruct, but we went through, I want to say, an entire other round of peer review where I kind of took on board the comments from those 6 respondents. And then I think they sent it out to like 3 new readers or something. And I think they sent it back to like the 3 most critical readers or the 2 most critical readers from the first round, along with a bunch of new readers. And then I had to kind of incorporate those comments. But I could see at that point that the piece was just getting stronger. I was getting excited because I could see that the piece's analysis was getting, you know, subtle in a way that the initial drafts had not been. My own thinking was able to develop in dialogue with these reports. So that was, you know, painful and labor intensive, but also really productive, and I could just see the thing moving along. I think the challenge became word count, because every time they asked me to do new things, I had to add more prose. And so at some point they, you know, I touched base with them and said, look, you know, if you really want me to take on this issue, I'm going to need a paragraph and I'm already at the limit. And they said, well, just go ahead and just write it, because this is important and we've decided it's important. And here, there was a huge historical contingency that was important, which was that the main editor was on leave that year, and the associate editor, had taken over and liked the piece and was willing to kind of let the word count out. But as the thing was moving through the proofing process, the main editor of the journal came back from leave and was just like, "What is going on with this crazy piece? Like, who authorized this?" And so, you know, at that point, they were like, "Well, look, we've been telling this guy for a year; he needs to keep writing. So he's written all this, and we're going through copy editing, and so we're just going to let this go." And so, you know. And apparently, you know, the editor signed off and the piece went forward. But I think it was one of these things where there was a contingency, and that I think if that other editor had been in place, the piece might not have proceeded or would have looked very different. So anyway, so that's...
Wow, that's... I mean, that's incredibly useful. That's excellent. I mean,
okay, okay. I'm glad that was...
What did you guys think? Because we've been talking about...
Seems like a slog.
Oh, yeah. We've been talking about different pathways academic publications, and how does it begin, where do you get the initial inspiration, how does it incubate, and everyone has a different style. This is incredible. This is just incredible.
Oh, I'm glad.
Taking us through the step-by-step, and the nitty-gritty of it, and the engagement with the editors, this is just wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, one thing in terms of the slog, I mean, it was a slog. It's very, very labor intensive, and there are people that write books and the timeline that it took me and the energy that I put into this article, right? So on one level, like, this was an enormously professionally counterproductive essay, right? Like, this essay, like, you know, I could have spent this time writing a book and getting promoted and, you know, becoming a full professor, which I am still not. So, but I wanted to have this particular kind of intervention. In terms of the overall timeline, I have to say, like, the whole thing did not, relative to some other pieces, including another AHR piece I've written, which took actually more time than this piece, in a way, partly because the AHR was very expeditious with these reports. They were great about getting back, you know, getting the readers. There are basically two places in the timeline where things really slow down, right? One is the readers, who sometimes need a kind of, you know, prodding from the editors, and they were really good about getting these reports. And then the other is, like, what you do with the reports once you get them. And in both cases, I decided that, like, they got the reviewers' reports back to me quickly, and then I decided I was going to make this a top priority because they were giving them a lot of attention, and I knew they wanted to move this forward. And so the whole thing, really, when I look at it in retrospect, is that the piece came out in... I started writing the piece in, like, January... basically December 2009... and I finished the first draft in January 2010, and the thing came out in December 2011. So it actually, like, things moved at a pretty steady clip, in part because of the... So I guess I would say, in terms of... Yeah, there was a slog part of it, but actually, the things moved pretty efficiently, especially on the journal's end, so... anyway.
Yeah, the floor is open.
You're kind of... in the article mentioning you're countering that, like, technocratic tendency that you say, like, shows up in political science and IR, and then you're building on some of the work on imperialism and cultural studies, and I'm interested in this kind of, like, the cross-disciplinary surveying that you do, and I was wondering if was there a particular, like, lit or concept in cultural studies or in literary studies or in any other non-historic, like, other, like, humanities or social scientific discipline that was helpful for you, even if it's not, like, maybe directly applicable to the U.S. case? Also, since the article has come out, like, have you had any conversations, or do you have a sense of the reception of this article, like, outside of history?
Yeah, so in terms of interdisciplinary, in terms of my own approach to this field, like, the kind of American studies scholarship on empire that was emerging in the early 1990s, especially in the work of Amy Kaplan and this volume, Cultures of U.S. Imperialism, was really formative for me, and the essays, and some of the essays in those volumes in particular. I knew that was a major touchstone for this scholarship. Over time, I developed lots of discontents with that scholarship too. I had, you know, so But in terms of my own on-ramp to this, that I think was a major on-ramp. And then the other was people putting me in touch with the scholarship on European colonialism that was emerging in the 1990s too. And people like Frederick Cooper and Stoller, you know, at that time based at the University of Michigan, you know, had a center for this kind of scholarship. And they were, you know, bringing graduate students and young professors out to Michigan to talk and to kind of talk across. And their work was very interdisciplinary to begin with. So there was a way that in terms of the models that I was looking to, which was very much that kind of, you know, European colonial history that was emerging, the fact that that field had already bridged race, gender history, cultural history, the history of policy, you know, gave me a methodological model in some respects. And so, yeah, so I think, yeah, so I feel like the cultural analysis stuff was already stuff that I was familiar with through the American Studies work, but it was really about trying to figure out how to make that talk to the history of state power and institutions, and that's where I saw the Cooper and Stoller framework especially just being really powerful for me, and just really and kind of wondering, like, why doesn't this exist for U.S. cases, and what might that look like for the United States' case? And so, yeah, and then able to kind of look around at the political science literature and these other fields, and sort of, you know, and that being my base now in this kind of more methodologically rich historical and historicist kind of discourse, and then looking at kind of the technocratic discourse that was emerging from IR, sometimes using the category of empire, sometimes not, and having a critical ground from which to approach that and being like, okay, this is not a great analytic, this is more like primary document material that needs to be historicized. In terms of the reception of the piece, you know, I haven't really tracked that carefully. So I don't, you know, my sense is that it's being read and cited actually more by non-U.S. historians than by U.S. historians. Like, I think it's actually...
That makes a lot of sense to me, actually.
Okay, yeah. Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense.
So I think, that's my sense, is that, like, people that sometimes email me about it will email me, and they'll be working in a completely other imperial context. Someone working on the Roman Empire will read this piece and be like, this was, your conceptualization was so helpful. And so it's, but I don't, you know, I don't think the piece has been taken up especially forcefully in the diplomatic history community or the U.S. foreign relations history. I mean, but I you know, I think that's one of those things where, like, in terms of thinking about the life cycle of a piece, is grappling with reception or non-reception, you know, and kind of what you do with that. And I feel like it's a mysterious process. And it's one of those things where you can drive yourself a little crazy trying to focus group a kind of piece to... make sure that it goes down smooth, but then it's probably less likely to make the kind of intervention that you want. But anyway, but I feel like basically in terms of that long period of vetting where I was taking it around to friends and colleagues, that's where I was getting a lot of that sense of, like, look, if I can convince this inner core of people that what I'm saying is smart and worthwhile, then that's fine. And then, you know, but I think, you know, for also a piece that's arguably trying to do a lot of different things, people find ways into it, and they essentially break off a piece of it and say, oh yeah, this phrase is useful, right? Yeah, there are a lot of people also who just basically relate to the footnotes. They're like, thank you for gathering all these footnotes together, you know, the bibliography, which, you know, it's always felt a little strange. Like, okay, I did put a lot of work into the bibliography, but, like, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, you feeling like you've built some beautiful edifice and people being like, these are such nice bricks that you put together, and being like, well, thanks, you know.
I'm pretty sure, Paul, you've given someone somewhere in some graduate school a good, great reading list.
Yeah, exactly.
Comp reading list.
No, exactly. Yeah.
In the field of U.S. and the world.
Yeah.
You don't need to, you've saved them the label.
Yeah, exactly. Time. Yeah, so that's worthwhile, I guess.
Yes.
Interrelated questions about that relate to exceptionalism. I thought the discussion around exceptionalism was, like, really useful for me and helpful. I mean, the whole piece was really helpful. The whole it was really amazing to have this, like, I was reading it, I was like, I wish there was a piece about this for, like, every field in, you know, like, just the way to conceptualize history and the way different people conceptualize history and different fields conceptualize history. It was just so useful to get this, like, real groundwork and where this idea of where it should go. And with exceptionalism, right, I want to be careful around it, as you kind of point out, that you don't want to prop up exceptionalism, but you also don't want to flatten out particularities, mm-hmm. right, and say, like, oh, exceptionalism doesn't exist, mm-hmm. so you have to, you know, flatten empire. Thinking about it in terms of how I've seen exceptionalism, I kind of wanted to get your take on, like, if this is kind of how exceptionalism within thinking about imperial power, like people within that imperial power thinking about the exceptionalism of their own empire, whether or not they call it an empire,
mm-hmm.
If it works this way in every context, in that, like, the way I've seen it work with American history is you find something that seems to be exceptional, and then you say, like, oh, because this is exceptional, it means we are exceptional,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, so in other contexts where they are similar, that gets dulled. Mm. Because it's like, because there are exceptional parts of my understanding, that means we are exceptional. Whereas every power has exceptional parts and similar parts,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't make it exceptional, but this idea that, I don't know if this is making sense, that the similarities don't count when you're coming at
mm-hmm.
it from an exceptionalist point.
That's
of view,
right. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
It's like, well, sure, there's similarities, but I'm seeing the exceptional part, and that means we are exceptional, and therefore you dull both the similarities and the exceptions that
mm-hmm.
other powers may have.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you think that's Is that like a useful way to conceptualize how exceptionalism kind of works within the minds of people who you know buy into it one way or another?
Yeah, no, I think that you're right on there. I mean, that in a way, part of what exceptionalism does is it makes the similarities exceptional.
Yeah.
Right? You sort of take, you know, it sort of, as you said, people will sort of take places where things look like they're very comparable, and you just put them conceptually on different tracks so that they do not align and they cannot be made to speak to each other. I'm drawing very much on my advisor, Dan Rogers' wonderful essay on exceptionalism, which I recommend to everybody, U.S. and non-U.S. historians alike, but where he makes this distinction between comparisons and exceptions and between uniqueness and exception, and essentially saying, you know, all national histories are unique, right? We know that the forces out of which nations emerge, the forces which structure them, their presence and impact in the world all vary, right? So, because I think that was one of the initial criticisms of international history, was essentially saying, like, you're going to do away with national distinctiveness. And that's a false dichotomy. And Rogers is really the one who points that out and sort of says, no, we can and should attend to what makes nations and their histories distinct. But what exceptionalism does is not that kind of comparison. It actually is about flattening the diversities of every place else, right? So it's about, there's a rule, right, that organizes all the other cases, but not this one, right? And so so it's about this kind of lopsided, homogenizing comparison that is what makes exceptionalism a kind of variant of comparison, right, but one that's really distortive and ideological. And for me, like, and the reason I began the piece with the exceptionalism piece, because it feels like that's what opens up everything else, right? In a way, the reason why empire is such a problem in American public life and in the historiography has to do with exceptionalism, right? It has to do with this sense that because the United States is whatever, a model republic, leader of the free world, sort of bastion of democracy during the Cold War, whatever the ideological matrix, empire presents a problem for that ideologically, and therefore it has to be bracketed in order to preserve ideologies of American exceptionalism. So And I think there, you know, as I began to kind of work through the ways that empire is operating in an exceptionalist way, it occurred to me that there were these two different ways that perhaps a little cutely I kind of identify as this kind of noun way, where you say the U.S. is not an empire and has not had an empire, right? And the other is this adjectival way, where you say, okay, it's an empire, but it's a benevolent empire. It's an empire, but it's a democratizing empire, right? Where you do this modifier thing, all of which is about, you know, bracketing all the other imperial histories, right? All those are the real empires. We don't need adjectives for them. But this one is the one that's different, right? And so I would just wanted to kind of call those out and to say, no, let's engage in real comparisons. Like, let's, and once you do that, you know, and there's the section which I think the journal actually asked me to add, where they say, work through the actual comparison. Like, I was critiquing a lot of the bad comparisons, but they said, okay, run a section where you actually compare the U.S. empire to other empires. You know, we want to see you actually do this. I was like, really? You know, I can't just critique other people's bad comparisons. Okay. And so I sat down and I added a section where I sort of say, well, look, you know, the United States is, you know, during its foundational decades, a self-consciously Republican empire, you know, but it's not the only Republican empire, right? It is a Protestant empire. It's not the only Protestant empire. In the 20th century, it's an empire that works through the nation state, but so does Soviet Union in some respects, and so does Japan. And so that's the section where I essentially start to break out and say, look, there really are lots of ways and aspects that the United States can be comparable if we want to see the comparisons, mm-hmm. right? So.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, Jonathan.
Yeah, so on criticism, I was just wondering, as I was going through the piece, how you really kind of avoid looking like an iconoclast for the sake of iconoclasm, but at the same time use well, you know, what you glean from, you know, the people that come before. Because I mean, that thing about your critique of like, you know, Orientalism and a few of the others, it was charitable, but also firm. And just the weight of your critique is you know, quite heavy. I was wondering how, you know, as you approach these kinds of issues, how you manage this.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think it was really important for me to be very clear that there was a huge amount of work that came before what I was doing and it completely enabled it, even as what I was trying to do was charting some new ground and trying to do some new things. So, and as I was writing, I had to think about, yeah, to what extent, what am I really critical of here and what's the tonality of that criticism going to be? And I think... you know, I think just also realizing the importance of that culturalist kind of American studies critique for my own formation, I wanted that to be a very friendly critique and a kind of sympathetic critique, because I really felt like in terms of the analytical work that work was doing and the political work that work was doing, those felt like people that I was allied with. You know, I wanted to reserve tougher criticism tonally for, you know, the technocrats and the people that I really saw as instantiating actually existing forms of global inequality in American empire in the present. Because of the kind of, because of the kind of intersections between that analytic vocabulary and the politics that it underwrote. And so... that's where I wanted to have the tone be, you know, sort of more forceful. But in terms of, you know, the question of iconoclasm, I really wanted to do the opposite. Like, I kind of wanted to, because I felt like in a way part of the problem I had with the scholarship was that it was like, in a way where people would use the term empire, it would be, among critical scholars, they would do it in this self-consciously iconoclastic way, this kind of in-your-face way that was also really about themselves as authors. Like, look at me, I'm going to, like, be the truth-teller. Like, I'm going to be the one that... And
I didn't... Close it out.
I'm going to call it out, right? And I just didn't want... I felt like that's just all about the author and, you know, and all about... And one of the things that it does is it neglects like all the enabling condition of this work, which is this enormous body of scholarship, right? And so one of the things that I really wanted to do was to actually cool off the tone of the piece so that it would not be one of these charged kind of pieces that would just instantly date as an artifact of the Bush era and the war on terror. And just like, I was really, because I thought that if I did that, I would inadvertently have the piece fall into this trap of like the coming and going of the empire literature, right? Where it would just be like, okay, you know, because I was thinking, okay, at some point, the United States is probably going to get its act together and like, and elect someone who can actually run the empire in a way that like brings on the Allies and does what happened during the Cold War in some new form and makes it all look better. And, you know, like, and then this is going to evaporate again. Like, this analytic category and all this political polemic is just going to go away because that's what it does, right? And so if I hooked my rhetorical wagon to that, I'm going to call out, you know, I mean, I do some of that in my other writing, my more public-facing writing. But if I wanted this piece to have durability and to actually help constitute a field that could begin a dialogue that was just, you know, kind of be ongoing, where we're just going to get better and more subtle and more interesting histories, critical histories of American power, you know, that I needed to actually cool off the tone. And so that was a very deliberate thing on my part. To try to, you know, not to make the piece more palatable, or to kind of, you know, but actually just in a way to kind of rhetorically establish that what I'm doing here is scholarship. That it's about subtle distinctions, sharp distinctions, I like to think, distinctions that have a critical politics. But this is not about, you know, criticizing the worst things that the Bush administration did, because, you know, American empire has taken lots of different forms over time. And in a way, my model here was, you know, can we make empire an analytic category in the same way that like race and gender analytic categories, right? Where we're looking at global inequalities through a critical lens, and empire is the way we do that, right? You know, I looked at like gender history and just the different waves of gender historiography or critical race historiography and saying like, of course they were prompted by social movements that had to do with aggressive defenses of patriarchy and white supremacy, but they also kind of outlasted, like they're not tethered to the rhythms of public politicization around those issues. Like they have an autonomy within the academy. And why can't we deal with empire? Like, can't this just be a scholarly conversation that we can just keep having whether or not the larger political culture is talking about empire or not? Because I knew Americans are going to stop talking about this. The second they can, they will. You know. And so if we tether the scholarly conversation to the public conversation, it's going to go through this whipsaw again. And so, yeah.
Can you talk a bit about maybe methodologically questions we might ask when trying to divorce like the what you call ahistorical standards, right, and looking at technocracy and technocrats, and trying to understand the way that these agents measured function, success, and failure, right? What kind of questions might we ask? How might we even question ourselves in looking at this and saying, am I using an ahistorical standard and just not understanding that I'm doing that? How do we get at that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, think part of it is just thinking about the genealogy of like what are you reading and where are you getting those questions from, right? And I mean, what I'm criticizing there in a way is this like subset of the U.S. foreign relations literature that is, you know, I think of it as this intellectual revolving door where you really get people that in their actual intellectual sociology are moving between these roles. And you know, essentially translating authority that comes from the national security state into some, I think, illusory sense of scholarly competence, but one that has a lot of authority within that field. And those are the egregious cases, right? If somebody who comes in and says, you know, somebody who uses, you know, they're presenting a historical paper, but it's, you know, they use a language of, you know, what are the lessons that the current state can take from this history? People that, you know, scholars that are operating in what should be presumed to be a cosmopolitan intellectual environment, but who use we for American, right? Like that happens, right? And so that's the egregious stuff. That stuff that I don't think is necessarily that productive to argue against. I mean, because it's just so egregiously in your face and bad. But I think the more complicated one is, yeah, is the ways that these terms can, you know, sinuously make their way across these boundaries. And I think just realizing that, like, yeah, that there is a huge terrain of intellectual work and thinking around American power that is uncritical and or apologetic, and that that has set the dominant terms of the conversation. So I think, you know, one of the things that I've I don't do in this piece, but I'm going to do in the book I'm writing, is to sort of really think about the ways that the historiography of the U.S. and the world, in a way, is so profoundly tied up with Cold War U.S. empire that it actually needs to be kind of decolonized from its own historical conditions of possibility during its foundational decades, that we need to kind of think about this very self-consciously as an effort to take ways of understanding global inequality and American power's role in the construction of global inequality, and to kind of use critical genealogies that were available during the Cold War period, right, among dissenting intellectuals of all kinds, right, but to take that and to actually move some version of it, not unreconstructed, but to move the analytic categories from that critical literature into the center of the analytic conversation. And that's really, in a way, what is happening in this piece in some respects, or what I'm trying to do in the piece. But to really see that as a kind of, an overthrowing of, although that makes it out, I guess, to be a kind of toppling in a crude way, but there's a surgical dimension to it where it has to be very subtle in terms of how you understand the ways that the kind of the root structures of this field and its way of conceptualizing itself have been so sort of cultivated within an imperial history that it requires that kind of critical genealogy to even begin to create the space for an alternative. And I feel like, you know, we're seeing really exciting work in the field of kind of the intellectual history of the U.S. and the world and U.S. foreign relations historiography that's starting to do this, where you're getting people with really precise intellectual history skills that are kind of looking at, like, how does liberal internationalism emerge in the 40s and 50s in a way that, you know, is a policy discourse but a historiographic discourse at the same time, right? And looking at the kind of the critical intellectual frameworks around the U.S. and the world that emerge from the decolonizing world, that emerge from African-American foreign relations scholarship, that begins to kind of develop a critical vocabulary for thematizing American power, but which remains self-consciously excluded from diplomatic history and from the most powerful authoritative positions within that field. And so, and I think that is really helpful in terms of thinking about kind of how we get to where we are now and maybe where we take it from here. So.
Thoughts? Well, I've had a few thoughts on this. The question of, the intersection of empire and cosmopolitanism, right? I mean, in some ways, when you talk about empire, you're talking about the opening up of the world. So, I mean, I like what you do here, which is to advance empire as a counterpoint to this triumphalist, you know, globalization narrative, right? That ties in with cosmopolitanism as well. We've arrived at this age of cosmopolitanism, interconnectedness, and, you know, global connections, and this is wonderful, this is a wonderful moment in history, let's all get together and celebrate, you know. Mm-hmm. That's, and yet, what you do here is to advance empire as a critical intervention, as a critical revision of that narrative, to say, well, you know, there are all these hierarchies and this. In some ways, this moment of globalization reinforced rather than, you know, disrupt you know, the hierarchies, the global hierarchies that exist. So for me, that's a critical intervention. I want to see, so there's on one hand, you have the narrative of connection, right? There's interconnectivity. But then you also have tensions, right? So, and both of them are happening at the same time. There's an African, a Kenyan literary scholar, he's at Princeton, his name is Simon Gikandi. He writes on, you know, these questions of globalization. He's a cultural critic of globalization and cosmopolitanism. He's writing kind of similar somewhat to Stuart Hall. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are raising questions about this moment. And so for me, it's always been this trend. There's always been this tension between the narrative of connection, which is historical. You do a great job of saying that empire can help us get to that, can mm-hmm. help us, you know, get to the connections mm-hmm. between U.S. histories and histories of other parts of the world in productive ways, you know, in all kinds of arenas, politics, development, culture, religion, all kinds of. So these connections are there and they are real. And empire can help us talk about both their productive but also their imperial aspects. But at the same time, you know, you have all of this is going on. And you have also you have to make the case also for dominance, for oppression, for violence. Because Simon Gikandi likes to talk about how it's not just the openings, but also the closures. Kind of similar mm-hmm. to how Fred Cooper, mm-hmm. my advisor, talks about these things.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at not just openings and possibilities, but also closures and mm-hmm. and strictures.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how you reconcile those two. I mean, how is it the way you envision empire as an analytic tool? Can it, as a category, accommodate those two, the connections,
yeah.
but also the conflicts and the closures and so on?
Yeah. I think part of what I had to do in this piece was to kind of think about the relationship between empire as I was conceptualizing it and other kind of critical vocabularies. And one of the things that I was thinking about is that, you know, within the American Academy, within American public life, like by the late 20th century, the discourses of anti-racism had become much more mainstreamed and also defanged in a way that, you know, sort of made the critique of ethnic nationalism in the 1990s and the notion of this contrast between a globalized world that was going to, of itself, dissolve racism's, ethnic nationalism's hard senses of difference, right? That just struck me as kind of interesting in a way to just think about, like, sort of, and eventually I began to think about it as really being the byproduct of a kind of conservative critique of racism mm. being more publicly salient than the critique of empire. So what you could do is essentially take the sense that, like, after the fall of communism and the integration of the world under American power and kind of deregulated sort of capitalist power relations, you know, difference would be dissolved. And this was this linkage was very, very powerful and made its way into the historiography,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, where people are saying, well, in fact, this is going to be a way when Americans' own nationalism is going to be dissolved through these flows, right? And this discourse about, and a lot of it was linked to this dichotomy between states and flows and kind of states and capital, which was itself a hugely problematic dichotomy that became a very important part of the conceptual apparatus during the 1990s when a lot of these things were being conceptualized. And that's where, in a way, where the kind of Cooper and Stoller framework that sort of said, look, it's imperial states that are building these flows and they're building them in their own interests and they, you know, and they are recalibrating difference. They're not liquidating difference. They're recalibrating it in really complicated ways. But that globalization and difference were not opposites. They were deeply intersecting. And that was, you know, was really compelling for me. And I think, and that in a way was one of the, you know, animating, you know, sort of questions of my first book was essentially to sort of say, you know, what happens to American forms of difference when the United States is trying to build a different kind of empire under very different conditions? And realizing that, like, yeah, globalization wasn't the opposite of difference. Like, you know, the entire way the United States relates to the Philippines develops in a crucible in which the United States is trying to interconnect the polities and the economies and the societies in this hierarchical way, right? And then, you know, over time as I was reading, I realized that there had been lots of other historical moments in which the promise that different forms of difference could be transcended through projections of centralized global power. It's a recurring theme, right? Roman cosmopolitanism, right? 19th century British cosmopolitanism, right? I mean, you have these late 19th century, sort of British imperialists who begin to talk about liberal subjecthood as being, you know, transcending race, right? That there are going to be British subjects that are white and non-white, and they can be accommodated within this expansive, you know, framework of British power, and that was part of what made British power exceptional, right? The French do this within a Republican framework, exactly. Right? And then realizing that what emerges in the United States case is a historically specific and distinct but non-exceptional version of a kind of imperial cosmopolitanism. And that is emerging, I think it really emerges in the 1950s and 1960s. It often gets conceptualized as Cold War civil rights, right? That's what happens but I actually think it's imperial cosmopolitanism. It's you know, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy administrations, Johnson administration saying white supremacy is a huge problem for American empire. And we need to at least make rhetorical and public gestures and some legal accommodations to dismantle the most egregious versions of this if we want to truly be a global power. And that imperial cosmopolitanism made its way into the scholarship, right? In a way that, you know, so what I was trying to do was to kind of come up with a more critical counter-imperial approach to some of these themes about cosmopolitanism, yeah, in a way to also uproot some of their power within the scholarship and within the historiography.
Mm-hmm. Kind of bouncing off of that, this is making me think about, you know, one of the ways that civil rights is taught, I think in undergrad courses, at least this was how it was taught to me, although I was in Canada, so who knows if that's a different thing.
That's where all the good stuff is happening,
yeah,
so.
This idea that the civil rights movement was partially, like, the reason that Kennedy and LBJ went along in some ways with the civil rights movement is because they see themselves on the world stage and they want to be this imperial force that is seen as democratizing. And they see that the, like, internal strife of the nation and like, race relations within the United States is going to kind of counteract that, right? And so they're like, okay, well, if we want to be this world power that's seen as the, you know, spearhead of democracy, we need to make some moves internally, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, like, that seems to be a good argument, or you know, it's an interesting way to look at the civil rights movement, but I'm wondering if there's a way to, like, layer it a little more, if we really insert empire or imperialism within national movements. So I'm wondering if you kind of have a framework of how you would conceptualize including imperialism within national studies.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, I mean, I think this question is pretty self-serving because I look at, like,
yeah,
internal national issues, but all of this resonated a lot with me, and I'm wondering now, like, how do I really interpret national history with an imperial,
yeah,
kind of lens of imperialism, mm, in a way that is not doing a disservice,
yeah,
to either national history or this transnational imperial framework. You know, I've,
yeah,
you know, walked that line.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the objectives of this piece is to make clear that empire is an analytic, that we need to do what is conceptualized as domestic history, right? Yeah. That because I think even for some historians that would say, okay, yeah, we need empire. The United States is doing lots of stuff out there, right? I mean, I've heard that, and you do get that. Like, yeah, it's good that there are people doing this foreign relations stuff, and empire is maybe a term we need for that stuff out there. But I think, in a way, that's part of the problem, right? Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, because empire is also what's happening domestically, in quotes, and that there's this dynamic, ongoing, contrapuntal relationship between what's happening on the, quote, inside and what's happening on the outside, right? And so, and in a way, this was what the Cooper Stoller literature did for me very powerfully, in a way, more than the American Studies scholarship, because I think the American Studies scholarship was, in a way, all inside the Americans' heads, right? It was all about American ideologies and how that informed what was happening. But the idea that, like, you can't understand modern European national society without understanding the ways in which these national formations at the level of culture, economics, politics, national self-identification are all sort of deeply imbricated with empire and inseparable from empire, right? So that was the starting point, right? Was this dynamic, the sense that you were going to have to remake national history in light of empire, and that there was no distinction between national history and imperial history in these other cases. And so that was my starting point, looking at the United States case and sort of saying, well, why don't we have this for the United States? Like, there's every way that the United States is the byproduct of settler colonialism across North America, right? That it's the byproduct of overseas colonialism in the early 20th century, dollar diplomacy, post-war global power, right, is reconstituting, you know, American society at every level, right? That you don't get these enormous scale of American wealth and power, right? That is, it's predicated on tapping into global sources of energy and resources and raw materials, etc. And that what was interesting, in a way, was the moral invisibility of the empire to the people most sort of benefiting from it. That it was like, and the conceptual invisibility, the kind of writing off of that. And to me, that, when I talk in the piece about the kind of limited liability empire, where you kind of conceptualize what you're doing as a nation in part so that you don't have to think about the imperial underwriting and the kind of imperial dimensions of one's own nation. So, you know, in terms of, in practical terms, how people who conceptualize what they're doing as national history or local history, how they make sense of this, I think, on the one hand, always keeping in mind the ways that other scales of history and social experience are always imbricated in these global forces, right? That, you know, here I'm drawing on the work of Charles Bright and Michael Geyer, who've done these wonderful sweeping essays about global history, where they sort of essentially argue that after the mid-19th century, for a whole complex of reasons unfolding globally, you really can talk about a single interacting global history that is wrought through empire, technological change, trade relations, that basically you can really talk about a hierarchical, integrated, uneven global whole. And it is wrought with imperial hierarchies. It is fraught with polarizing modes of difference that organize it. But that it is a whole, right? And so when I think about doing local history, you know, their work, along with the work of the kind of critical empire scholars, have, you know, always make me think about, okay, how is this locality imbricated in that global whole? How is it positioned? What is its relationship, you know, within that global whole, right? And thinking about it in terms of relative power, right? Like, to what extent is this space a metropolitan space that is making decisions for other spaces? To what extent is it on the receiving end, where it's, right? Sort of how is it situated within a kind of connective chain of global power relationships? And just keeping that in mind, and that's going to be enormously varying, right? That's not a one-size-fits-all, right? That it's a set of questions that you have to ask about how the particular space that you're studying interacts with the global whole, right? And there, I think, you know, and for me, the category of empire helps us think about that global whole in ways that problematize hierarchies and global power relationships. Whereas I think the cosmopolitanist discourse would be, okay, I'm going to study what's, you know, the place that I'm studying and its connectivities to show how this place was not as isolated, that it was contributing, right, that it was part of this global cosmopolitan matrix. And to me, that, you know, that's not what I'm interested in. I'm really interested in trying to think about how these spaces interact with a globally uneven and hierarchical order.
So one of the, along those lines, one of the things that I teach this course on, it's an undergraduate course on, I call it it's the history of poverty in Africa.
Mm.
One of the topics, you know, as you can imagine, is aid, the politics of aid, foreign aid. You know, so, and one of the things, you know, I've had to read up on a lot of, you know, literatures, and one of the things that fascinate me when I, you know, when I began conceptualizing this course is just how, you know, as I read more and more into it, it's like how just intertwined the histories of the Midwestern part of the U.S., right? You know, the agricultural communities, mm-hmm. the corn belt, how intertwined is, you know, the politics, the policies regarding that part of the U.S. You can talk about the politics in that in the Midwest. You can talk about policies regarding agriculture. You can talk about all of those things without looking at the imperialism of U.S. food aid.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. I mean, that was quite eye-opening for me.
Yep.
You know, there's no way you can talk about an entire region of the U.S., its politics, its history, its, you know, quotidian, you know, whatever, cultures, and, you know, without talking about this huge, you know, kind of system of U.S. imperialism. That is, it's a multi-billion-dollar thing, and it's one of the untouchable, how do you Americans say it? You say it's one of the...
Third rails.
The third rails, that's right. That's the expression I'm looking for.
Uh-huh,
one of the third rails of American politics. Mm-hmm. U.S. food, the imperialism of U.S. food aid. So that's one example that I just came to my mind. It's like, yeah, this is... And I didn't understand it at first. But when I started looking into it, because, you know, I'm talking to these American students, and, you know, they're giving examples. Some of them are from the Midwest and from the agricultural community.
Yeah.
They're talking about, and they themselves don't quite get it in that frame.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so, you know, and then we've had to kind of talk our way through to really understand the imbrication of these histories, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I think, in a way, a lot of the really exciting work is kind of commodity history that would look at things like Midwestern corn or wheat and the ways in which particular agricultural interest groups connect up to U.S. state programs, right, whether developmentalist or kind of, and foreign aid programs, and become interest groups that then become lobbying, you know, lobbying groups that are shaping U.S. foreign relations, right? And so thinking about, and that depending on the specific commodities and the kind of competitive relationships with other producers, that can produce different formulations. So, you know, you can have, you know, the sugar beet industry of the United States that is contesting U.S. projections of power in the Caribbean because they're afraid it's going to bring sugar-producing areas into the U.S. tariff sphere, right? So you can have that commodity formation that says, look, let's not intervene, or if we're going to intervene, let's not do it in a way that brings these areas into greater commercial intersections. But then you can have the Midwestern producers that are essentially pushing for export markets, pushing for relationships to U.S. foreign aid. I think, and thinking then about the ways in which, those interest groups have enormous impact on American politics, right, as concerned domestically, national politics in quotes, right? Those things also shape, you know, American commodity production, American food habits, et cetera, right? But there are these ways that, like when you said, the Midwestern, you know, sort of students don't necessarily see it that way. It's about trying to create, you know, through the scholarship, a set of new visibilities, right, where you can see these connectivities, where you sort of say, well, look, there's a reason why Iowa corn gets these enormous subsidies from the federal government, right? And it has something to do with American empire, or a lot to do with American empire. I mean, you know, and there are lots of places where those connections can be made visible more easily, and I think places where they're more difficult to make. And in some ways, the more difficult ones to make are the most important linkages
that's,
to make.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I think, so I think, but that's the task, is to kind of use the places where these connections are most easily visible in a way to shed light on the places where they are the least visible, but still very potent and present.
Says something that people from the Midwest, the students from the Midwest, don't conceptualize it this way, and also at the same time that the Midwest is thought of to be the place where, like, there's so much worry about exporting jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
The Midwest is seen as like a self-contained thing that just creates things for America, right?
So that's right.
Yeah, it loses the politics, the narrative, or the vocabulary of loss.
Yeah.
And deprivation. We are being.
Yes.
We are losing, but we're not. There's
no
commensurate discourse of gain, man.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And you know, and there's a long scholarly tradition of actually trying to take the areas of the country that one might think of as the least imperial and putting them at the center. I mean, if I think about William Appleman Williams, I mean, his argument about American empire in the late 19th century is that it's about the Midwest. It is about, it's where he's from. He's from the Midwest, and he essentially says this is the seat of American empire, and it's all about export markets for American agricultural goods. So his argument is actually that, you know, that there's a kind of agrarian origin to American overseas empire. Unfortunately, people don't fully follow up on his framework,
obvious. It's not obvious when you think about U.S. imperial entanglements. You
yeah.
Know, Midwest. What's
yeah.
You think about the
yeah.
coasts, right?
That's right. People think about it's that heartland ideology,
yeah.
right? Which is about the kind of notion that because an area within essentially 19th century geographic categories is seen as isolated
mm-hmm.
and kind of the most internal to the country, but I think you know it's those kind of internal places that are conceived of as the most internal in quotes. Spaces that need to be opened up, right? And you know, one of the things I say, I think briefly in this piece, but which I go into greater length in this later AHR piece, is that in a way, part of what empire both enables and requires is the dismantling of the distinction between the internal and the external, between the domestic and the foreign, right? So that even the conceptualization of there being a region that is like the most internal of the internal spaces
yeah.
needs to be discarded, right?
Yeah.
That it's all about how these spaces connect to the global condition. Right?
So before we let you go, one, I promise you, this is the final.
Okay,
because
sure.
I can't let you go without talking about this, because this has come up in this seminar multiple times. Concepts and terms that have a public resonance, that function in the public in public discourse, you do go into that in this article
mm-hmm.
a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Empire is one of them, for obvious reasons. I mean, you can't, the New York Times, the New Yorker, I mean, they are popular venues. You encounter this term, you encounter this concept, even in conversational, you know, interactions with people, you know, in conversational discourse, you know? Empire, everybody throws it around. Everybody,
at the
it's everywhere.
Stop,
yeah. Imperial. So, I mean,
or it's also places that those venues are places that avoid this language too.
Yeah,
I mean,
in
where,
some ways,
yeah.
Or misuse them,
or
right?
Misuse,
or
yeah,
misuse them.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
how do you navigate? I mean, that's the you know, this has come up before, you know, in our discussions. Words like that, terms like that, concepts that are so charged in the public arena.
Yeah.
How do you, in other words, rehabilitate them within
yeah.
a scholarly context?
Yeah.
And use them in the way that you are advancing empire.
Yeah.
In which they can be used quite, you know, intelligently, but also precisely to demarcate certain, you know, epistemological boundaries and help us to think through certain. How do you rescue them, as it were,
mm.
from that domain where they're abused and misused
mm-hmm.
and denied and, you know, and then, you know, how do, that's, they are so, it's not just empire, but in this case, there's so many concepts that,
yeah.
That have come up in this, that are so charged
mm-hmm.
in the public space, you know, in the public sphere, that sometimes it's so difficult to co-opt them or to
mm.
incorporate them into how we talk about these historical issues. In this case, empires, I see it everywhere. It's overused. In my field, everything is about empire. Everything. It's like, man, this is not imperial. You know, I get frustrated
mm-hmm.
with this sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm sure there are similar terms that we can come up with. But,
yeah. No, it's interesting. That last critique, I've had, some people who have not read the piece, I think, very thoroughly, I have to confess, who come up and said, you know, aren't you just saying that everything is empire, right? And they just, you know, essentially, and I feel like that exhaustion is also symptomatic of the problem, right? In a way, it sort of says, I don't really want to engage with what this concept can do, and so I'm going to take it out to its extreme, some hypothetical extreme, in order to basically dismiss the inquiry as a whole, right?
Right.
So,
right.
And I do think that there is, with any concept, there is the risk of conceptual inflation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the definitions become very imprecise, they're driven more by a logic of polemic and rhetoric
mm-hmm.
than a logic of precision, and everything can get folded into them. I think every conceptual category, and I think that is very much about the political economy of the academy. Frankly, it is about the kind of capitalism of what we do, where what we do is we come up with a concept, we want our name on it, right? Or, I mean, I'm saying this is what we're encouraged to do, right? We come up with a concept, we put our name on it, we erase everything that's been done before, right, as a precondition of that, in order to help with that branding exercise. We market it, and then we try to make it apply to everything, right? So there's like, I mean, it's a kind of capitalist model of conceptual expansion. And I see this as endemic within the academy. I mean, you know, it's not exclusive to the empire scholarship. It's not exclusive, but I do think that it operates against precision. It operates against an appreciative approach to the existing scholarship. And so we do have to really think about the risks because of the kind of branding and territorial capitalism of the conceptual field in the academy. So in terms of navigating the boundaries between the kind of public and scholarly worlds, I mean, I think, on the one hand, for me, the important thing is I want whoever my audiences are to be thinking about ways of kind of critically problematizing transnational and global inequality. Like, that's the goal. And whatever concepts can help us do that in a way that doesn't alienate them and which makes those questions more legible, I think is productive. So for me, empire is part of that toolkit. And I think it is necessary to the extent that if we don't use it, we end up in weird exceptionalist apologetics, you know? So, but I do feel like in part because it is, so charged, right? And so, that using it sparingly in the public debate, you know, not feeling cowed about using it, but using it sparingly, understanding that for many readers, even ones that are amenable to a critical argument about American power, something in them is going to find the aesthetics of the term and its connotations unpalatable, right? And so, and I don't want to let those people off the hook. I want them to have to engage, right? I don't want to make them comfortable by, you know, but I also don't, but I, you know, as someone who thinks about the reader experience and thinks about how to communicate, also as a teacher, you also don't want people to shut down.
Yeah.
And so you have to use vocabulary that is going to be legible to people, and they're going to, you know, still continue to trust you as an authority. And so I think that's a balance. I mean, that I think is at the level of both rhetoric and conceptualization, where you have to think about the rhetoric of what you're doing, without sacrificing conceptual sort of precision. I mean, on the question of rehabilitation, I mean, one thing that I'm concerned about a little bit is that, like, again, to the extent that we make this about the word empire itself and not the critical thematizing of global inequality, you know, I've been in rooms with people that, you know, historians, smart historians, who have no problem with the language of empire. They have no trouble talking about American empire. You know, the term doesn't need to be rehabilitated for them, but they just write from the position of protagonizing American power. They're like, okay, I'm going to write about the success or failure of these American empire managers during the Cold War, whether they did what they did, you know, successfully or not. The technocratic idiom,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they've lost the critical politics,
right?
Right? And right. So, and to me, that's the loss, right? So, you know, in a way, like, I feel like the empire term and concept is, for me anyway, a means to a longer set of goals and projects. And I think there is a concern that once the New York Times begins to talk comfortably about American empire in a way that is not critical, but is just descriptive, right, that it can actually get brought completely on board and assimilated into American national identity in a way that will make the United States you know, less distinct, you know, in the sense that there is this historically this great ambivalence, but maybe that will go away, but without the critical analytics and without the critical politics, which I think the term currently has that kind of force. And so I want that to be present regardless of what concepts are advancing it. But in the present rhetorical context, empire is one of those tools.
Well, this has been great. I don't know about you. I've learned so much, but this is excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for your questions. I've really enjoyed this.
So can we give him a round of applause?